Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be hosting this episode. But first, have you heard about the new Hulu series, Daughters of the Cult? It's about the LeBaron Group down in Mexico, and our very own Lindsay Hansen Park is interviewed in it. So Sunstone is hosting a watch party of the series on Facebook, which will include interviews with some of the people in the documentary, as well as discussions of the episodes. It's going to be great fun. And you can come join us by searching Mormon Primetime Watch Group on Facebook and joining the group. Hurry over soon so you can be part of the discussion. So, it's the beginning of an election year, the national trauma we inflict on ourselves every 4 years. And coincidentally, I recently ran across the book The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements by Eric Hoffer. It was published in 1951, but I'll tell you, it seems entirely contemporary. Basically, the book documents the life cycle of mass movements and the people who joined them, and it gave me an entirely new view into this upcoming election. But as I read, I started to realize that early Mormonism was a mass movement, at least according to Hoffer's definition. And then I started wondering, is it still a mass movement? I hate to sound like clickbait here, but you won't believe what happened next. I found out that you and I are actually part of the mass movement cycle Hoffer is talking about. We're playing the role he describes perfectly. And our efforts are going to result in something totally different than we think they will. I promise, this is going to freak you out. But to understand how it works, we need to see how Hoffer defines what a mass movement is in the first place. As examples of mass movements, Hoffer used groups such as the Nazis and the Bolsheviks, but also early Christianity. So these groups have different enough beliefs that you can tell that he didn't define mass movements by what they preached, but rather by how they functioned. He says that what a mass movement basically does is give people's lives a strong meaning by stripping away their individuality and absorbing them into a tight group that's willing to sacrifice anything to change the world. So what kind of people are attracted to mass movements? The shortest way to describe them is frustrated. They haven't been able to make the world around them work. They find themselves blocked, and their dreams are always out of reach. The interesting thing is, these aren't people who have been permanently frustrated. Hoffer gives the example of people he calls the new poor. So, those who knew a better life than they live now, and, quote, who throb with the ferment of frustration. The memory of better things is as a fire in their veins. Thus, many who join a rising revolutionary movement are attracted by the prospect of sudden and spectacular change in their conditions of life, unquote. But the interesting thing is that they aren't necessarily looking for financial relief. Rather, quote, they want the chance at a new beginning. They have the feeling that by the possession of some potent doctrine, infallible leader, or some new technique, they have access to a source of irresistible power, unquote. So, in other words, they've lost faith in the existing cultural structure and leaders. They see the present as irredeemably spoiled, but they still feel bound up in it, so they're looking outside of themselves for the idea or group or leader that will change the world, and they want to join that group. But interestingly enough, they don't want to change the world for their own individual profit. Quote, a mass movement appeals not to those intent on bolstering and advancing a cherished self, but to those who crave to be rid of an unwanted self, unquote. They're so disappointed with themselves that they simply want to leave that self behind. They want to find an idea or group or leader that can constitute their entire identity. Quote, faith in a holy cause is to a considerable extent a substitute for the lost faith in ourselves, unquote. What an interesting description. It actually reminds me of some of my ancestors, the ones who joined the church in the late 1800s. So Sven Svensson, my great-great-grandfather, was a school teacher in Sweden, and he made a good living for his large family. But for some reason, he suddenly lost his job, which means that they also lost their house, since it was part of the school. So they moved into a tiny house and eked out a living sewing aprons, living on the very edge of poverty. So they were the new poor that Hoffer describes. And one day, they met the LDS missionaries. They converted, and they sent the family to Utah one by one at great sacrifice. And once they got to Utah, they did exactly what Hoffer said they would. Quote, "It was due to the fact that the majority of the immigrants to America were of the lowest and the poorest, the despised and the rejected, that the heterogeneous millions blended so rapidly and thoroughly. They came here with the ardent desire to shed their old world identity and be reborn into a new life," unquote. Hoffer's description also reminds me of where I found the most success on my mission. You know, not in the suburbs, but in the low-rent apartment buildings. That's Mission Field 101, right? The humble are more receptive to the gospel. So that's the kind of person most likely to join a mass movement, according to Hoffer. Now, how does a mass movement integrate the new convert? First, quote, "It brings the individual into a compact collective body," unquote. So what this means is that the convert enters a group with very strict codes of conduct and belief, so strict that it seems like everyone is part of one body. The interesting thing is, quote, "The adherents of a rising movement have a strong sense of liberation, even though they live and breathe in an atmosphere of strict adherence to tenets and commands. This sense of liberation comes from having escaped the burdens, fears, and hopelessness of an untenable individual existence. It is this escape which they feel as a deliverance and redemption," unquote. Second, the mass movement, quote, "endows the convert with a new imaginary self," unquote. So this new imaginary self is the movement, you know, its principles and goals. It's kind of like those people on Facebook who are either constantly reposting things from their political organization or their church, or they're filtering everything that they say through those organizations. I have some friends like these, and I wonder, so who are you? And their answer seems to be the movement I'm part of. It actually reminds me of a nice elderly English couple that I got to know in Toronto, whom I really came to like. Once the wife was teaching Sunday school, and she said, "Remember when you were first converted to the church, and you just wanted to run up to the top of the CN Tower and shout, 'Listen to what I found,' and it just took you completely over?" And, of course, the New Testament teaches that when you get baptized, you bury your old life and rise with a new life in Christ. That's why baptism by immersion is so important to Mormons, right? Because the symbolism needs to be there, burying your old self in the water. And, of course, when you go through the temple, you receive a new name. Third, a mass movement, quote, "implants in the convert a deprecating attitude toward the present, riveting their interest on things that are not yet," unquote. Which totally makes sense, right? Because to the convert, the world is irredeemably screwed up. The whole purpose of the movement is to release them from the present and head into a new and amazing future. And in all likelihood, this glorious future is a little too glorious to actually be possible. The Promised Land may be full of milk and honey, but only if you import them. And the reason for these outsized promises is that, quote, "all that is practicable, feasible, and possible is part of the present. To offer something practicable would be to increase the promise of the present and to reconcile us with it," unquote. Which is why, quote, "the unemployed are more likely to follow the peddlers of hope than the handers out of relief," unquote. Once again, I think you can see tons of early Mormonism in this description. You know, it's in the founding document, the Book of Mormon, where Lehi's family rejects the present and heads toward the Promised Land. And then Zenith does it. And then Alma does it. And then Hagoth does it. And then the brother of Jared does it. The interesting thing is that all of them find the Promised Land. But then it turns out to not be so promised after all. They find out how much work it is and how many things go wrong. It's almost like the Book of Mormon's like a critique of Promised Landism. Maybe it played a part in helping the saints be a little more realistic about what they'd find way out west. Though they probably learned a lot about that in Nauvoo, where so many people died from the diseases they caught from the nearby swamps. And do you remember when all those early apostles left their families and farms to go on missions to England? Or when Joseph Smith dragged all those people out of Kirtland and headed toward Missouri and Zion's camp? Or how Brigham Young was constantly making people who had already settled in Utah pull up stakes and go settle somewhere else? Mormonism had a way of making people willing to dump the present and head into an ill-defined but purportedly glorious future. As Hoffer writes, quote, "Dreams, visions, and wild hopes are mighty weapons and realistic tools," unquote. But it goes further. Hoffer notes that, quote, "the taste of continuous successful action is fatal to the spirit of a mass movement," unquote. Which I suppose is why the Mormons actually seem to gain strength and resilience from being, you know, kicked out of so many of the early places they settled. Because it all went to show that the present was indeed messed up. If ever their plans went awry, it was because of the screwed up world, not because of a fault with Mormonism or Joseph Smith. Perhaps this is just an idea. Working against a mass movement is the best way to make it successful. You know, if you just let it succeed early on, it'll stay small because it will succeed at its small things and reconcile itself with the present and lose its vigor. As Hoffer writes, quote, "things which are not are indeed mightier than things that are," unquote. Fourth, a mass movement, quote, "interposes a fact-proof screen between the convert and reality," unquote. Of course, the first reason for this is that the people in the movement have already rejected the present. Therefore, anything that comes from the present is also rejected. The second reason is that the movement believes that it is in possession of an absolute truth, which spreads, quote, "a net of familiarity over the whole of eternity. There are no surprises and no unknowns. All questions have already been answered. All decisions made. All eventualities foreseen," unquote. Does that remind you of the famous First Presidency message, "when the brethren have spoken, the thinking has been done"? And since the mass movement has picked up its adherents from the frustrated, they already lack faith in, quote, "the actual and the possible. Salvation can come to them only from the miraculous, which seeps through a crack in the iron wall of inexorable reality," unquote. And then add this, which is about the most Mormon thing I've ever read. Quote, "the devout are always urged to seek the absolute truth with their hearts and not their minds," unquote. We can especially see this when facts do start penetrating the screen. I mean, it's been one of the main dynamics of Mormonism for the past 20 years that facts from church history can upset a lifelong believer's testimony and send them on a quick trajectory out of the church. And of course, those facts appeal to the mind rather than to the heart. And finally, mass movements, quote, "prevent, through the injection of passions, the establishment of a stable equilibrium between the individual and his self." Once the harmony with the self is upset and a man is impelled to reject, renounce, distrust, or forget his self, he turns into a highly reactive entity. Like an unstable chemical radical, he hungers to combine with whatever comes within his reach. He cannot stand apart, poised and self-sufficient, but has to attach himself wholeheartedly to one side or the other, unquote. So, in Mormon terms, I guess you'd say, the Spirit has borne witness to you of the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon, which means Joseph Smith is a prophet, which means the church he founded is God's church, and God will never let the leaders of his church lead it astray. So, now, you no longer need to consult yourself. You simply have to follow the church or mass movement, taking up any passions it injects you with. Hoffer writes, quote, "What Pascal said of an effective religion is true of any effective doctrine. It must be contrary to nature, to common sense, and to pleasure." It's futile to judge the viability of a new movement by the truth of its doctrine and the feasibility of its promises. What has to be judged is its corporate organization for quick and total absorption of the frustrated, unquote. So there you have it, the basics of how a mass movement works. It, quote, assimilates the individual into a compact collective body, endows them with an imaginary self, implants a deprecating attitude toward the present and rivets their interest on things that are not yet, interposes a fact-proof screen between the convert and reality, and prevents, through the injection of passions, the establishment of a stable equilibrium between the individual and their self, unquote. Now, in our current culture, this all sounds like an indictment of the followers of mass movements, right? But Hoffer points out that there are actually some definite upsides to being a true believer. For example, quote, "When the times become unhinged, it is the practical people who are caught unaware. It is often the fanatics, and not always the delicate spirits, that are found grasping the right thread of the solutions required by the future," unquote. And here's the interesting one. Quote, "The people who stood up best in the Nazi concentration camps were those who felt themselves members of a compact party, of a church, or of a close-knit national group. The individualists, whatever their nationality, caved in," unquote. Now, if that wasn't enough to convince you that Mormonism is a mass movement, let's take a look at how Hoffer says a mass movement begins. It starts with what he calls, quote, "men of words." A man of words prepares the ground for the rise of a mass movement by discrediting prevailing creeds and institutions and detaching them from the allegiance of the people, unquote. And we can certainly see this in some versions of Joseph Smith's first vision, where he says that God told him that all the current churches were abominations, right? He also produced the Book of Mormon, which rewrote American history so as to make its readers look for a very specific kind of restoration. You know, one that would be attached to the history the Book of Mormon was recounting, which was, of course, Joseph Smith's church. But I think we could also think of Sidney Rigdon as one of the important men of words, since when the Mormon missionaries arrived, he had unwittingly prepared his entire congregation to be receptive to them through his sermons. And of course, he was part of the Restorationist movement, which was trying to unshackle itself from both Catholicism and Protestantism in order to find its way back to primitive Christianity. So, all of those people were also part of the men of words who prepared the way for Mormonism to thrive. So when these people of words have thus prepared the ground, the movement is handed off to the fanatic. In this case, Hoffer describes the fanatic as someone with, quote, "boundless self-confidence, which prompts them to give full rein to their preposterous ideas." What are the talents requisite for such a performance? Exceptional intelligence, noble character, and originality seem neither indispensable nor perhaps desirable. Indeed, the quality of ideas seems to play a minor role in mass movement leadership. What counts is the arrogant gesture, the complete disregard of the opinion of others, the single-handed defiance of the world. Charlatanism of some degree is indispensable to effective leadership, unquote. And in these few sentences, I think we see most of the indictments that critics level at Joseph Smith, you know, the reasons he should not be taken seriously, portrayed. But it turns out that all of them were essential to him creating a successful mass movement. Perhaps his ideas were derivative of the discourse already going on in American Christianity. Maybe he was arrogant and a charlatan, and he definitely tried to defy the world single-handedly. The Nauvoo Legion was second in size only to the U.S. Army at the time. But it turns out that these bugs were actually features. And he had one more feature that was essential to the continuing success of Mormonism. The capacity to, quote, dominate and almost bewitch a small group of able men. These men must be fearless, proud, intelligent, and capable of organizing and running large-scale undertakings. And yet, they must submit wholly to the will of the leader, draw their inspiration and driving force from him, and glory in this submission, unquote. But as important as the fanatic is to invigorating the mass movement by throwing off the shackles of the present and stoking hope in the future, Hoffer says that the minds of fanatics feed on critiquing and dismantling whatever is around them, even if they help build it themselves. Quote, "Their unrest and disquietude can find satisfaction only in some conspiratorial activity of the mind, in perpetually plotting the disintegration of whatever the setup of the moment happens to be. Even when the fanatics do not breed dissension, they can still wreck the movement by driving it to attempt the impossible," unquote. Which is, of course, what Joseph Smith was doing, like when he dismantled the banking system with the Kirtland Safety Society and lost a lot of money for a lot of people. And then, toward the end of his life, he was dismantling monogamy and trying to get polygamy to fly. And it was wrecking the church. And this all fits with Hoffer's theory. Quote, "When the same person or persons or the same type of person leads a movement from its inception to maturity, it usually ends in disaster. Only the entrance of a practical man of action can save the achievements of the movement," unquote. And who are we talking about now? Brigham Young, of course. Quote, "The man of action saves the movement from the suicidal dissensions and the recklessness of the fanatics. But his appearance usually marks the end of the dynamic phase of the movement. The war with the present is over. The genuine man of action is intent not on renovating the world, but on possessing it," unquote. And that is exactly what Brigham did. He brought the saints to the Great Basin and organized them so they could possess it. Quote, "The genuine man of action is not a man of faith, but a man of law. Still, he can't help being awed by the tremendous achievements of faith and spontaneity in the early days of the movement, when a mighty instrument of power was conjured out of the void. The memory of it is still extremely vivid. He takes, therefore, great care to preserve in the new institution an impressive facade of faith and maintains an incessant flow of fervent propaganda," unquote. And yeah, have you ever read Brigham's remembrances of Joseph Smith? He really loved that guy. He venerated him. And he taught the saints to love and venerate him too. Brigham fit the man of action role perfectly. And since then, the LDS leadership has largely been filled by people of action, those who lead so that church members are, quote, "unified only through their unquestioning loyalty to the institution. Spontaneity is suspect, and duty is prized above devotion." Whereas the life breath of the dynamic phase was protest and a desire for drastic change, the final phase is chiefly preoccupied with administering and perpetuating the power won, unquote. So you and I are living in Mormonism after the dynamic phase. And you have to admit, it's been pretty successful at perpetuating itself. I mean, $100 billion in the bank ain't bad at all. And the church is still great at inspiring sacrificial acts from its members. You know, from small things like fasting to paying tithing, from giving up a few years of your early 20s to go on a mission, to taking on high investment positions like Relief Society president or bishop, to, you know, even putting your career or business on hold to preside over a mission, or even giving up some of your retirement years to go on a mission again. Speaking of missions, Hoffer argues that proselytizing isn't about spreading the word. Rather, it's, quote, a passionate search for a final and irrefutable demonstration that our absolute truth is indeed the one and only truth, unquote. In fact, quote, the creed whose legitimacy is most easily challenged is likely to develop the strongest proselytizing impulse, unquote. And who has the biggest missionary program in the world? Now, the thing is, mass movements are part of a cycle, with movements cycling from previous movements. And, of course, Mormon history is full of splinter groups, and all of them have essentially the same life cycle that early Mormonism had. And that cycle continues today. We can see the people of letters right now, both nationally and in the church, that are setting the stage for future movements by, quote, discrediting prevailing creeds and institutions and detaching them from the allegiance of the people, unquote. But Hoffer isn't talking just about people who are actively discrediting the church. He's also talking about people who are demythologizing it, you know, bringing it into the scholarly fields, analyzing it, taking a more scientific approach to its history and sociology, which, of course, includes everything from Sunstone to Dialogue to BYU Studies to the Joseph Smith Papers, which is run by the church itself. We're all a part of this larger movement toward demythologizing. And it seems like doing so is a good way to keep the church relevant to the changing times, right? To help it keep pace with social issues and such. But Hoffer has a much different idea about what's going on. He says that, quote, by denigrating prevailing beliefs and loyalties, the militant man of words unwittingly creates in the disillusioned masses a hunger for faith. And therefore, often prepares the ground not for a society of free-thinking individuals, but for a corporate society that cherishes utmost unity and blind faith. A wide diffusion of doubt and irreverence thus leads to unexpected results. The irreverence of the Renaissance was a prelude to the new fanaticism of Reformation and Counter-Reformation, unquote. And that, my friends, was the idea that blew my mind the most. Apparently, these people of letters, people who are discrediting or demythologizing the church, which includes church organizations, are, quote, indirectly creating a hunger for faith in the hearts of those who cannot live without it, so that when the new faith is preached, it finds an eager response among the disillusioned masses. And further, they also undermine the convictions of those who can get along without faith, so that when the new fanaticism makes its appearance, they are without the capacity to resist it. They see no sense in dying for convictions and principles and yield to the new order without a fight, unquote. So that's something I've been chewing on a lot. Apparently, some kind of faith, some kind of myth, keeps people stable. It keeps their lives feeling meaningful so that they aren't ready to be turned into fanatics, and also so they don't just yield when fanaticism arises. Hoffer actually gets into this a little. How to keep a society stable while still giving it room to transform. Quote, there are other safer substitutes for a mass movement, he says. In general, any arrangement which either discourages atomistic individualism, or facilitates self-forgetting, or offers a chance for action and new beginnings, tends to counteract the rise and spread of mass movements, unquote. And, weirdly enough, that kind of describes church. I mean, church does discourage atomistic individualism, you know, making you be part of a community on at least a weekly basis. It does facilitate self-forgetting, you know, through fasting, through tithing, through service, and it offers chances for new beginnings through ritual, through new callings, or through missions, or the repentance process, and all of it within a stable community. It seems to make us ask the question, would we be willing to give up some of our pursuit of the unvarnished truth? Would we be willing to put some of our critiques on the shelf? Would we be willing to put some time into a community that is far from perfect? Would we be willing to allow people to maintain their stability by maintaining their myths so that we could avoid the rise and spread of an especially vigorous mass movement? Because we certainly see some vigorous mass movements arising, and frankly, some of them scare me. Would we be willing to go to church to stabilize things? You know, participate in some mythologizing of the world, give some credit to the current stable structures, even if they are imperfect? Oddly enough, it may be physically and mentally healthy for us to do so. The True Believer reminded me of a book by Sebastian Junger called Tribe, on homecoming and belonging, because it was kind of the other side of the True Believer coin. So, whereas the True Believer paints the people who join mass movements kind of as those who, you know, just couldn't make reality work for them individually, so they joined this group fantasy, Tribe focuses on how important community is to humans evolutionarily, and just how difficult community is to find in today's world. Quote, numerous cross-cultural studies have shown that modern society, despite its nearly miraculous advances in medicine, science, and technology, is afflicted with some of the highest rates of depression, schizophrenia, poor health, anxiety, and chronic loneliness in human history. As affluence and urbanization rise in a society, rates of depression and suicide tend to go up rather than down. Rather than buffering people from clinical depression, increased wealth in a society seems to foster it. Unquote. Junger talks about studies the British government commissioned during World War II. Quote, before the war, projections for psychiatric breakdown in England ran as high as 4 million people. But as the Blitz progressed, psychiatric hospitals around the country saw admissions go down. Psychiatrists watched in puzzlement as long-standing patients saw their symptoms subside during the period of intense air raids. Voluntary admissions to psychiatric wards noticeably declined, and even epileptics reported having fewer seizures. Chronic neurotics of peacetime now drive ambulances, one doctor remarked. Unquote. One researcher, Charles Fritz, quote, was unable to find a single instance where communities that had been hit by catastrophic events lapsed into sustained panic, much less anything approaching anarchy. If anything, he found that social bonds were reinforced during disasters, and that people overwhelmingly devoted their energies toward the good of the community rather than just themselves. Fritz's theory was that modern society has gravely disrupted the social bonds that have always characterized the human experience, and that disasters thrust people back into a more ancient, organic way of relating. Unquote. So this makes people who join mass movements seem much more reasonable. They're simply looking to be in a tighter community, which is apparently the way humans are evolutionarily most happy. Quote, group cooperation triggers higher levels of oxytocin, which promotes everything from breastfeeding in women to higher levels of trust and group bonding in men. Both reactions impart a powerful sensation of well-being. Unquote. So Junger encapsulates the book's thesis at the beginning, telling about when he received his Selective Service card, quote, in case the United States needed to draft me, and I declared that I wasn't going to sign it. The Vietnam War had just ended, and every adult I knew had been against it. I had no problem, personally, with fighting a war. I just didn't trust my government to send me to one that was completely necessary, unquote. Ah, the men of words had been at work. Quote, my father's reaction surprised me. Vietnam had made him vehemently anti-war, so I expected him to applaud my decision. But instead, he told me that American soldiers had saved the world from fascism during World War II, and that thousands of young Americans were buried in his homeland of France. You don't owe your country nothing, I remember him telling me. You owe it something. The way my father put it completely turned the issue around for me. Suddenly, the draft card wasn't so much an obligation as a chance to be part of something bigger than myself, unquote. So it seems to me that from these two books, humans are going to find their way into something bigger than themselves one way or another, because that's what our brains are wired for. The question is, how is it going to happen? Through the great upheavals that Hoffer describes, or more gentle ones because, I don't know, we've learned to balance our need for independence with our need for community? Or because we've learned to make room for mythology and belief so that people, including ourselves, aren't starved for it? Or perhaps because we don't insist on perfection? In this sense, our effect on the world doesn't seem to spring so much from our commitment to specific beliefs as it does from our ability to interact with how belief and community work in the human brain, neither starving nor gorging it on either of them. Come to think of it, that's actually what Sunstone has always tried to do. I mean, we certainly have plenty of articles and symposium sessions that demythologize. But we've also always ended each magazine with a kind of devotional, and we have the Why We Stay session at our Salt Lake Symposium. And for a long time, we had hymn singing, accompanied by Alan Eastman and led by R. Dean Watts, who was a conductor at the Utah Symphony. I personally was never really into hymn singing as a spiritual practice, but I'll tell you, when Ardeen led the singing, it was amazing. In fact, if you've got 3 minutes, go to sunstone.org/remembering-Ardeen-Watts, where you can watch him whip the audience into full-throated song. I promise you'll be inspired. Yes, even you and your cold, dead heart. Or, if you don't want to remember that long URL, you can go to the Sunstone Review at sunstone.org/sunstone-review, and it will be near the top of the postings. Well, thanks for joining me for this week's episode of the Sunstone Podcast. And remember to join us on the Mormon Primetime Watch Group on Facebook for all the discussion around Daughters of the Cult. I'll see you there.